Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is claiming a huge win in Thursday's primary election for the leadership of his ruling Likud party. Netanyahu tweeted his prediction just an hour after the polls closed there, saying that he will continue to lead the state of Israel to incredible achievements. Netanyahu faced off Thursday against former government minister Gideon Saar for the Likud leadership. Whoever heads the right-wing party would likely be its candidate for prime minister in the March general election. Bad weather Thursday, however, kept voter turnout low. Less than half of eligible Likud members cast ballots. As closing time approached, final results were not expected until later Friday. A tragedy in Turkey, where a boat filled with migrants sank. Reuters' Emer McCarthy reports.
Seven people have died and 64 had to be rescued when a boat carrying migrants from Pakistan, Bangladesh and Afghanistan sank in eastern Turkey's Lake Van. The accident happened at around 3 a.m. on Thursday. The lake is near the border with Iran, where migrants regularly cross into Turkey, heading west towards Europe. It was not clear why the migrants were on the boat in Lake Van, which is completely within Turkey's borders. Five people were found dead at the scene and two died in hospital. According to the governor's office, the 64 people rescued were taken to nearby hospitals and shelters. Search operations are continuing.
Disaster officials in the Philippines say a typhoon that hit the central part of the country on Christmas Day killed at least 13 people. That typhoon brought sustained winds of at least 100 kilometers per hour. Tens of thousands of people evacuated their homes, with many turning to improvised shelters in schools, gyms, and government buildings. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Riot police stormed shopping malls for third day of Christmas protests in Hong Kong Thursday and detained a number of people after masked protesters roamed through shops, some throwing paint and disrupting restaurant services. Christmas in Hong Kong is usually bustling with commercial activity, but this year, streets and malls and shopping districts were filled with tension. Police fired tear gas, rubber bullets, and pepper spray at protesters and beat and arrested many of them. They also conducted indiscriminate stop and search procedures on shoppers, passers-by, and journalists during the past three nights. Meanwhile, on Thursday, hundreds of mostly black-clad protesters shouted and marched through shopping malls across the city. Their actions were part of the six-month anti-government movement to pressure authorities to meet their political demands, which include universal suffrage and an independent investigation into police brutality. U.S. states are taking on a new strategy in dealing with being on the front lines of the 2020 election. AP's Ed Donahue.
Deval Patrick launched his presidential campaign on November 14th. That meant he had to collect 11,000.
120 state and local election officials heard from an Army officer with battlefield experience.
If the democracy is under attack and you guys are the ones who are like at the pointy tip of the spear, why shouldn't we train that way?
Eric Rosenbach's message involves a different kind of battlefield, defending free and fair elections.
You train, you rehearse, you exercise, you fail, you learn from the failure, and you go through that whole cycle again.
Oregon's election director Stephen Trout says people like him need to deal with the hardest and most challenging election issues.
Being able to differentiate that, and I think, you know, that's really consistent with the military approach of broad-based attack and knowing where all of the different information sources may come from.
Ed Donahue, Washington.
Thousands of people knelt in prayer in Indonesia during ceremonies marking the 15th anniversary of the Indian Ocean tsunami, one of the modern history's worst natural disasters. AP's Karen Chamas.
The massive December 26, 2004 tsunami was triggered by a magnitude 9.1 earthquake off Sumatra Island. The giant wall of water killed about 230,000 people in a dozen countries. Indonesia's Aceh province, which was closest to the earthquake, was hit first and hardest, with more than 170,000 people killed in Indonesia alone. Survivors and relatives of the dead attended memorial ceremonies and left flowers at mass graves of victims in the provincial capital Banda Aceh. Denny Arianto and his family travel to the gravesite every year. "We always come to the mass graves of tsunami victims because we don't know where our family is buried," he said. I'm Karen Chamas.
More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Paul Alexander in Washington, sitting in for James Buddy. Today is Friday, December 27th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Rwanda's capital is dealing with the aftermath of a downpour that killed at least 12 people, and Doctors Without Borders has stopped anti-Ebola operations in the eastern DRC.
There are people that would not go to a healthcare facility because they're afraid of armed forces, because they have a different history with armed forces. And we have always said that healthcare facilities should not be armed. There should not be armed people within them. And people should be able to have access to healthcare facilities that are neutral.
That was Trish Newport, MSF's Deputy Program Manager for Emergencies, on the difficulties of containing Ebola in a conflict zone. We'll also hear about the Botswana opposition's plan to appeal a ruling that upheld the presidential election results. And we'll have the fourth part of Darren Taylor's five-part series on China's growing role in Africa.
The key thing is what return they can get and the cost associated around them. And I've seen them go wherever the opportunities really are. And I see a lot of them actually going to Southeast Asia.
That's banker Edwin Pong, head of the Johannesburg Chinese Association, on some Chinese business people leaving South Africa because the government doesn't have a sound plan to revive the sagging economy. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's sports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Heavy rains that ravaged Rwanda's capital and other parts of the country on Christmas night claimed at least 12 lives, destroyed 113 houses, and ravaged more than 50 hectares of land. The Ministry of Infrastructure says some Kigali residents are not getting water because heavy rains overwhelmed the water treatment system, and forecasters say a repeat may be coming. Eugene Uimana has more details from Kigali, Rwanda.
This heavy rain poured down for at least 5 hours. Kigali says it recorded the highest measurement of 1 square meter of soil, receiving 140 liters of rain. Flooding raised houses, claimed people's lives, and damaged the water infrastructure. Many Kigali residents haven't had a drop in their taps since Wednesday. He says it is very hard not to have water on days like Christmas, where activities like cooking and cleaning are highly needed. The Ministry of Infrastructure says flooding affected the Kimisagara water plant that usually treats 24,000 cubic meters daily. It has temporarily suspended operations due to turbidity or cloudiness from suspended particulate matter. The ministry says turbidity hit a record of 54,000 units from the normal 14,000 for water to be treated. Minister Kleva Gatete assures residents that they are working hard to bring the city back to normal. He says, as I speak, government workers are monitoring treatment process. They are working tirelessly. I can guarantee you that if there is no other heavy rain today or tomorrow, people can get water, but if it rains again, things will get even worse. Emabri Gahigi, the director of Rwanda Meteorology Agency, warns the government and the general public that it is forecasting similar heavy rains. He says, in the next 3 days, we'll be having heavy rains, but which gives a bit of light. The big problem is that the forecasted rain will hit the already affected areas again. We should be more prepared. The Rwandan government hasn't estimated the damage from the rain yet, but it says the cost is high. It says the one bit of good news is that more than 6,000 Kigali residents were evacuated from wetlands and high-risk zones last week, or the loss of life might have been higher. Eugene Uimana for VOA News, Kigali.
Medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says it has stopped Ebola prevention operations and other services in a town in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo due to the presence of armed government forces in several facilities. Operations have stopped in the town of Biakato in Ituri province, just north of North Kivu. Both provinces are struggling to control the epidemic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
MSF, known as Doctors Without Borders, says it had no choice. The group says it had to leave Biakato because the presence of military troops inside its health facilities goes against its principles of neutrality and impartiality. The deputy program manager for emergencies programs, Trish Newport, tells VOA the problem surfaced at the end of November. Following attacks by armed groups, three Ebola responders were killed and many others were injured. In the wake of the violence, she says the government in Kinshasa sent security forces to the area to protect the Ebola operation. Newport says she understands the need to protect civilians and medical personnel, but she notes the presence of the armed government forces discourages people from seeking medical care.
There are people that would not go to a healthcare facility because they're afraid of armed forces, because they have a different history with armed forces. And we have always said that healthcare facilities should not be armed. There should not be armed people within them. And people should be able to have access to healthcare facilities that are neutral.
Doctors Without Borders has been working in Biakato since 2016, supporting the Ministry of Health. Initially, its activities were focused on assisting victims of sexual violence. Since the start of the Ebola epidemic, it has expanded its operations to manage suspected and confirmed cases of the deadly disease. Over the past 3 years, Newport says Doctors Without Borders has built a strong, trusting relationship with the community. So the decision to close the operation was very difficult to make.
Biakato was really a place that we worked very closely with the community, and we weren't just focusing on Ebola. We really listened to the community, asking them what their priorities were. For instance, the community said at one point, we don't understand why you just respond to Ebola. We don't even have access to water here. And so we worked with the community to build wells in the community so that they did have access. What we were also doing was providing primary health care, providing pediatric hospital care.
Newport says MSF's departure is permanent. She says the organization's 18-bed Ebola treatment center and all other health activities will continue to be run by the health ministry. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The spokesperson for Botswana's main opposition, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, or UDC, says it's appealing a court ruling that rejected its challenge to the outcome of the October general election. Moedi Mowasa says the party has a strong case that claims voter irregularities and rigging. Chief Justice Terence Ranawani declared President Mokoitsi Masisi won a 5-year term, with the governing Botswana Democratic Party taking a majority in the National Assembly. He rejected the allegations of irregularities Tuesday. Mowasa tells VOA's Peter Claudy that the party is undeterred. Moedi Mowasa is the spokesperson for Botswana's main opposition, Umbrella for Democratic Change. He spoke with VOA's Peter Claudy from the capital, Gaborone.
Well, as you are aware, when the matters were brought before court, the case management system picked different judges for the different cases. But what happened is that the Chief Justice then decided, in terms of the power bestowed on him, to empanel the cases. And then what happened is we ended up with three judges per case. And in each of those cases that we have not been successful, there was it was by majority, 2-1. And our position is that the allegations that are raised in our papers are so strong and of national importance that they should be given an opportunity to be ventilated in an open court. The issue of elections is a serious matter, which has serious implications also on the credibility of those that are in power. So it's important that such matters, when the court decides on them, take note of that as well.
Is your party, the UDC, going to appeal the ruling as passed by the court?
The UDC is appealing the ruling.
And what are the prospects of your appeal?
We believe we have a strong case. And even from the judgments that were made by those who were in the minority, we required the 100 and to a large extent breathe life into the whole effort that we made. Because it's not the issue. issue here is that there are certain allegations, like I indicated earlier on, that implicate the head of the state. It implicates the head of the DIA, and it also implicates the chief executive of who is the Secretary General of the Revenue Party. These are very serious allegations. And there are also allegations of DIS or the Director of Security Services Slash Fund, and which ultimately means that the BDP, in fact, voted for itself in this election, not that one. But why did not vote for the BDP in terms of the information that they have uncovered?
Moeti, what do you say to your party critics saying that you don't have evidence and that you are just wasting people's time and public funds for this?
If the feeling is that we do not have evidence, then that we tested in court, that is our position. We also, it's not like we don't, we also have valuable time to look after. We can't go to court when we don't have anything. So to suggest that we are wasting the court's time is actually mischievous.
How have the people in Botswana reacted to your court challenge of the outcome of the October general election so far?
Well, generally people are saying, look, the allegations raised against by the UDC are of national importance. They are serious allegations. Why can't they be tested in court? If the BDP, people are saying, look, if the BDP is really serious about proving us wrong, why can't they do that in court? That's what people are saying, and not hide behind technicalities.
Moeti Mwasa is the spokesperson for Botswana's main opposition, Umbrella for Democratic Change. He spoke with VOA's Peter Claudie from the capital, Gaborone. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Paul Alexander in Washington, and today is Friday, December 27th. Authorities in Somalia have installed security cameras on major roads in the capital, Mogadishu, in an effort to deter ongoing attacks by the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. Residents and business owners have welcomed the stepped-up security, but as Mohammed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu, some analysts doubt the cameras will be enough to stop the attacks.
This month, Somali authorities began installing security cameras on some of Mogadishu's major roads, like the Makkah al-Mukarrama, which leads to the presidential palace. Abdullahi Farah, director of policy and legal affairs at the Ministry of Security, says the closed-circuit television cameras mounted at key intersections are meant to deter frequent attacks by the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. Farah says the security cameras will reduce criminal activities and prevent Al-Shabaab from carrying out attacks. He says these surveillance cameras will reduce the terrorist attacks. They will deter them from carrying out attacks because the cameras are tracking them. Therefore, he says our people are quite happy about the move and deem it a step forward. Mogadishu residents and business owners have welcomed the cameras in the city's business center, which the Islamist militants often target. Business owner Deqa Salad is one of those who think the cameras will make a difference. She says these cameras deter anyone from committing a crime. Even ordinary thieves avoid cameras like this, she says, because they're afraid to be caught on camera. But political analyst Hassan Barisi says the cameras will only deter terrorists who fear getting caught, not suicide bombers who were told that if they kill, they will be rewarded in the afterlife.
But the others who have been seriously brainwashed or heavily indoctrinated ones will not be avoiding anything, because in the end of the day, they think that they will go to heaven.
Barisi adds the cameras themselves will need security, as Al-Shabaab is likely to target them for destruction. The terrorist group in May ordered Mogadishu businesses with cameras to remove them or else they would attack. Ibrahim Haji, director of communications at the Ministry of Defense, says authorities will closely monitor the new security cameras. A special team is manning this system, which the government established, he says. He says he does not want to go into details as it is a sensitive matter. To further deter the Islamist militants, Somali authorities say they are also training and deploying more police and intelligence officers in the capital. Mohammed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu.
After more than a decade of rapidly expanding their investment in African nations, Chinese businesses and officials are showing signs of slowing the pace of growth. Some are making noise about corruption and stalling on some projects. Today, in the fourth of our five-part series on China's role in Africa, Darren Taylor in Johannesburg looks at this hesitation.
In South Africa, nearly 30% of workers are unemployed, and the rand is down more than 30% from a year ago. The almost total collapse of the state energy provider, Eskom, is a big contributor to the economic weakness. China lent Eskom $2.5 billion last year, but the country's ambassador to Pretoria, Lin Songqian, has referred to the utility as a debt trap. David Lewis, an economist and the director of South Africa's Corruption Watch nonprofit, says Lin's comments are highly significant.
In the case of the Chinese, it's rendered all the more significant by the fact that state-owned Chinese companies have not been absent in the state capture story in South Africa.
Government critics say under former President Jacob Zuma, some individuals and corporate interests encouraged state policies that allowed them to milk the profits from state-owned businesses, a practice known as state capture. In Kenya, Chinese business interests indicate they have doubts about the new standard gauge railway, or SGR, intended to link the port of Mombasa with Uganda. Two sections linking Mombasa to the town of Naivasha, northwest of Nairobi, are finished with Chinese funding. But China won't lend Kenya the almost $4 billion it needs to build the final track to the Ugandan border. Kenyan economist Anzetse Were has been following the SGR saga closely.
That third phase has been put on hold because of, I think, a lack of alignment between what the Kenya government wanted and what the Chinese government was willing to finance.
She says a major concern is the SGR's high cost, more than $5.5 million per kilometre of track. That's almost three times the international standard and four times the original estimate. Chinese officials and Kenya's railway operator did not respond to requests for interviews on the matter. But Kenyan officials have said its loans from China will be worth it when the SGR is completed, as it will spark economic development. Given concerns that the railway is overpriced, Were says it's not surprising that China has decided not to fund the final phase. For now, instead of building the new railway from Naivasha to Uganda, Kenyan officials say they'll upgrade the existing older line. Were thinks Kenya's leaders must be held responsible for the project's delays because they borrowed too much without a detailed, transparent repayment plan.
It is absolutely, in my view, unacceptable that a government can get into such significant debt and the general public has no idea what's going on. That, to me, is not a problem of the Chinese government. The Chinese government is not accountable to the Kenyan people. It is the Kenyan government that is accountable to the Kenyan people.
Examples such as the Kenyan Railway and South Africa's Eskom have some Chinese business people saying Africa is becoming less attractive. A leading Chinese businessman in Johannesburg who spoke to VOA on condition of anonymity says Beijing's officials in South Africa are concerned that the government doesn't seem to have a structured plan to revive the economy. As a result, some Chinese business people are leaving South Africa, says banker Erwin Pon, also head of the Johannesburg Chinese Association.
The key thing is what return they can get and the cost associated around that. And I've seen them go wherever the opportunities really are. And I see a lot of them actually going to Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia is the area that's really developing, low cost, etc. So
he says a lot of Chinese have returned to their homeland or moved to Australia, the United States and Britain, where they expect to find better opportunities in established markets. Some are looking at other parts of Africa for investment. China remains South Africa's largest trade and investment partner. Beijing loaned African governments and businesses more than $30 billion last year. As the Chinese Business Insider says, if Beijing turns off its cash tap, South Africa's economy will no longer be in big trouble. Instead, it will implode. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And it's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, Paul. We begin the sports with news from the CAF Champions League, where TP Mazembe, Esperance de Tunis and Etoile du Sahel will look to continue their perfect starts in the 2019-2020 Elite Club Competition group stage this weekend. DR Congo's TP Mazembe will be looking to record their third successive win in Group A when they face Angolan side CD Pinheiro de Agosto in Luanda on Friday. TP Mazembe's local rivals, AS Vita Club, will also be in action on Friday when they lock horns with the defending champions and Tunisian giants Esperance de Tunis in a Group D match in Rades. Five games are scheduled to be played on Saturday, and the action will be headlined by an encounter between Kabylie's local rivals, USM Alger, and South African champions Mamelodi Sundowns. Sundowns remain undefeated in the group stage, having registered a win and a draw, while Alger are winless, having recorded two draws, and the two teams will clash in Blinda in the Group C match. Lastly, Tunisian side Etoile du Sahel will be hoping to continue their dominance in Group B by recording their third consecutive win when they take on Sudanese outfit Al-Hilal Omdurman in Rades. Staying with football news, the Japan under-23 squad will warm up for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics with friendlies against two African countries, South Africa and Cote d'Ivoire. Hajime Moriyasu's squad will face South Africa at Kyoto's Sanga Stadium on March 27th before meeting Cote d'Ivoire at Level 5 Stadium in Fukuoka 3 days later. Both of the African sides have qualified for the Summer Olympics, where the men's soccer tournament is to be contested by under-23 sides containing a limited number of overage players. They will be joined by Egypt, which also secured Olympic qualification at the 2019 Africa Under-23 Cup of Nations. Away from football news, the 22nd edition of the African Championships in Athletics is set to take place from the 24th to the 28th of June 2020. Ahead of the championship, the Confederation of African Athletics is working in collaboration with the Algerian Athletics Federation to organize a successful championships where the best of African athletes will converge on the Algerian capital, Algiers. The stakes of the competition are quite high, as it will be one of the last opportunities for the continent's athletes to achieve qualifying standards for the 2020 Olympic Games. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Paul, in Washington.
That's it for this Friday, December 27th of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America as we count down the last days of 2019. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporter Peter Claudi, sports editor Samson O'Malley, and our engineers, I'm Paul Alexander in Washington, wishing you will have a very good weekend.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. Heather Maxwell, I know good music, and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Hi, my name is Larry London. Tune in on January 3rd at 1500 Universal for an interesting program on border crossings featuring the songs with time in the title. It's the new year, 2020 is here, and we'll be playing songs from Michael Jackson, Ariana Grande, Justin Bieber, all the hits with the word time in the title. See you at 1500 Universal on January 3rd, right here on Border Crossings.